At some point, I think I woke up again. There was a loud explosion, louder than anything I could even imagine. Then I passed out again. Strange smells, even stranger sounds. And now I'm floating in the water. The stars are overhead again. Crickets are chirping, and I can hear frogs croaking. It's a beautiful symphony, just like the one we heard back in the reservoir, the day I found true love, and I promised Julie Connor I'd marry her one day. I raise my hand up and look at the wedding band, reminding myself that part wasn't a dream. I tell myself I could lay here in perfect bliss, but my back starts to hurt. I roll over and realize I'm on the bank, only half in the water. Ping is nowhere to be found. In fact, everything is different than I remember. I get to my feet and look around me. The chain-link fence, the no trespassing signs. My elation is quickly usurped by my frustration. I'm thousands of miles away from my base, half a world away from where I ditched out of my plane. And I'm standing in the middle of the backwoods of Alabama wearing a Russian Army uniform. What am I going to tell my superiors? Hell, what am I going to tell my wife?
Buffalo Jump by Wendy N. Wagner. The corn dolly sat beside the bottle of gun oil on Anderson's desk. He wiped his hands a second time, grinning. The town of Coyote Creek had hired him as their sheriff because he could shoot a can of tobacco off a fence post 100 yards away, because he could hoist a drunk miner over his shoulder without throwing out his back, and because he didn't let anybody scare him, not even if they were giving him the business end of a shotgun. Somehow they'd forgotten to ask if he had a softer side. Assured that his hands were finally clean, he picked up his daughter's latest construction and tucked it in his breast pocket. He could give the dolly back to her when he stopped by the boarding house for lunch. Big Bess Sanford liked to tell the sheriff he spoiled his little girl, but as far as he could tell, there wasn't anything spoiled about his Mina. She helped Bess around the boarding house and could help her daddy out of his boots in under 30 seconds, which was pretty good for a kid with hands as small as hers. She'd knocked the socks off the school teacher at the start of school last week, too. Anderson adjusted his battered hat and knocked his grin into the semblance of a stern expression. He had an hour or two of patrolling before he could sneak back to Bess's place, and he'd better look the part. The door flew open, and Max Corbin, the grocer, launched himself inside. His tongue darted out the corners of his mouth, and his eyes had gone 2 sizes too big. He opened his mouth to talk and settled for licking his lips again, a lizard cornered by a hawk. "What is it?" "Bunch of men at the tavern asking about you," Max managed. "Mean-looking." Max's store had been robbed 3 times before the town hired Anderson. He knew what mean looked like. "I'll take care of it." Anderson grabbed the box of shells out of the top drawer of his desk and shoved 6 of them in his pocket. If things got ugly, he wasn't likely to get a chance to reload, but he liked to be prepared. He hurried out of the jailhouse. Coyote Creek wasn't the biggest town in southern Oregon, but it sat in the middle of enough successful mining towns to draw the attention of any number of bandits, rustlers, and hustlers. Farmers up in the Willamette Valley liked to brag about how peaceful and prosperous their state was. They didn't know squat about life down here on the Californian border. He strode into the tavern and stopped in his tracks. The black-haired man leaning on the bar was mean-looking, all right. Anderson didn't know anyone meaner. He'd been running away from him since he was 22 years old, and he'd prayed every night that Wallace McBurney wouldn't find him.
"Why, boys, it looks like Johnny Anderson done went and grown up."
McBurney gave the dry bark that passed for his laugh. It usually meant he was about to hit somebody, and for the 10 years Anderson had lived under McBurney's thumb, Anderson had been the nearest punching bag. "McBurney?" Anderson looked around the room. McBurney's men came out of the corners, closing around Anderson in an ugly circle. He recognized a few of the faces, Ugly James, Fat Malone, Piss Bucket Johnson. The other half dozen or so were strangers.
You lost both the Lee brothers?
Big Lee got stabbed by a whore down in Virginia City, that cheap sumbitch. Wee Lee's serving 10 years in Wasco for robbery. He never had the same touch with a safe that you did, Johnny.
Anderson felt a surge of anger. You let Wee Lee break a safe on a job? Are you crazy? I told you that boy didn't have the hands for it. McBurney lit a cheroot, his eyes fixed on Anderson even as his nimble hand struck the match. He had a way of rooting a man into place with his blue eyes, so pale they were like chips of ice struck from some mountain glacier. He blew a long stream of smoke.
You did tell me. But I had high hopes I could train him up the way I trained you.
He lifted the cheroot to his mouth again, the little cigar held between the blackened stumps of the first two fingers on his right hand. He could shoot like the devil himself with his left, but he could never train it up for safe cracking. Anderson's own fingers gave a twitch.
So, why are you here?
One of the gang spat a stream of chew onto the floor. McBurney shot him a look, and the kid Indian quailed. He had a bruise on his jaw, no doubt from McBurney's fist. McBurney hated chewing tobacco.
Do I need a reason to look for my adopted son?
Anderson raised an eyebrow.
I need a safe cracker. I've got a big score out in Malheur County. And you're the only one who can handle the safe.
I ain't opened a safe in 6 years, and I ain't ever going to open one again.
Anderson's hand went to the butt of the revolver sitting on his hip. McBurney followed the move. His eyes crawled up to the star on Anderson's breast pocket. He smiled, that smile of his, the ugliest Anderson had ever seen.
I'll just give you some time to think on that.
He beckoned to the kid Indian. The boy and the rest of the gang fell in step behind him. Their shoulders bumped into Anderson's as they passed, a long string of hard thuds. He stood his ground. The door thumped softly behind the last of the thugs.
"Reckon they saw me pull out my shotgun," the bartender called.
"Reckon that was it, Lem," Anderson called back. But he had a bad feeling things weren't over.
He patted his breast pocket. Patrolling be damned. He wanted to go give his little girl her corn dolly and a hug right this second. After a hasty lunch, he headed out to the Nielsen ranch. Lars Nielsen was his deputy, but Anderson would have wanted his advice even if he wasn't. Lars had given Anderson a job and a place to live when no one else would. He and his wife were the closest thing to family Anderson and Mina had, and he had taught Anderson what being a sheriff and a father really meant. 6 years ago, Anderson would have just run away from Wallace McBurney and Coyote Creek. Today, he was looking for backup. He found Ava and Lars in their barn, reshoeing their old mare. With the help of their hired hands, the old couple ran 300 head of cattle through the canyons and gullies of Coyote Creek. They were both tough as nails and smart as the critters they named the creek for. It took a minute or two to explain the situation, and then Lars clapped him on the shoulder.
"I'm here for you, son. You know that."
He turned to Ava.
"Beef's got to go down to the big field tomorrow. You think you and the boys can handle that?"
Ava had already taken the mare's foot between her knees, directing a flurry of half-English, half-Norwegian orders at Lars. The big man disappeared into the house and reappeared a moment later with his rifle and his going-to-town hat. He gave Ava a brisk kiss, and Anderson helped him load up his gear. The two men worked in silence. Lars's stolid presence settled Anderson's jitters. They'd faced down worse trouble than one small gang. It didn't matter who led this one. Anderson and Lars were a good team. They could manage this. He believed that right up to the moment they turned the corner of Main Street, and he saw Bess Sanford standing in the middle of the street with blood running down her face. Anderson crouched behind the fallen cottonwood, studying the gang's camp on the sandy peninsula. It had taken all evening for Lars to track the devils down to this site. It was the perfect location, impossible to sneak up on unless you could walk on water. Now a dense thicket of brambles and the curve of the creek stood between him and the site. The rush of the creek's current covered up any but the loudest noises, but his very bones could hear Mina calling to him for help. The flickering campfire lit up the armed men at their posts. Beside the fire he could see Mina huddled in a nest of saddle blankets. She looked so fragile, clutching her corn dolly to her chest with her tiny bound hands. Every fiber of Anderson's being ached for her. He crept away from the creek to the little ravine where Lars hid, divvying up shells and checking over their weapons.
"They're ready for an attack."
Anderson picked up a handful of pebbles and began arranging them in a semblance of the gang's camp.
"It's a good sight, too. The way the creek bends, they've got water on three sides. There's no way to sneak up on them."
"No." Anderson rubbed his eyes.
"God damn it. I keep trying to come up with something, but all I can think about is Mina tied up like that."
Behind them, a man shrieked. Anderson jumped to his feet.
"What the hell was that?"
A shot echoed off the hills. Men shouted. A horse screamed. Lars tossed Anderson a rifle and ran past him. The big man could move. Anderson ran after him, furtiveness forgotten in the chaos. A man smashed into him, screaming in pain and fear, knocking Anderson into the creek. Anderson splashed back onto the beach, his heart racing.
"Mina! Jesus God, what was going on in that camp?"
A searing blue light flashed, and the sudden stink of burned hair and flesh filled the air. Something pattered down on him, hot and sticky. It took him a second to recognize the hunk of flesh that struck his boot as a man's hand. He kicked it off and ran faster. He passed Lars grappling a tall man. There was no time to stop and help Lars. He had to get to Mina.
"Mina!"
He couldn't hear his voice, but he could feel his anger and his fear scorching in his throat. A stream of white light flashed past him. The smoke of his own burning hair assaulted his nostrils. But he only had eyes for one thing, his daughter, now clasped in Wallace McBurney's arms. The gang leader ran through the campfire, charging toward the creek. Anderson jumped over the stack of saddle blankets and stumbled over the motionless form of Fat Malone. He just caught himself as a giant hand closed around McBurney and Mina.
"Mina! Mina!"
For a second, the pair hung suspended in the grasp of the hand. No, not a hand, Anderson realized, his mind finally catching up with his senses. A net! And then they were wrenched through the air, skipping off the surface of the creek like a flat rock. In the darkness, a tremendous slashing accompanied them, and then they were gone, vanished into the night and woods beyond the creek. Anderson dropped to his knees.
"Mina,"
he whispered.
"Oh, baby, I'll find you. I'll find you."
It took him 15 minutes to find Lars in the devastation of the camp. He'd only been a boy during the Civil War, but he'd grown up hearing stories of what cannon fire did to a man, and he could only imagine that whatever that blue flash was, it put a cannon to shame. No noise, no explosion, just pure carnage. Half the gang's horses had been reduced to scraps by it. Fat Malone had a horse hoof driven through his chest by the force of the blast. Lars lay under the body of a tall man with the tooled boots of a dandy. Even in the dull glow of the dying fire, Anderson could see the neatly scorched circle on the back of the dandy's fringed leather jacket. It was as if a hot awl had punched right through the man's body. And when Anderson rolled away the dandy's corpse, he saw without surprise that the hole continued through Lars. The look of surprise on the deputy's face suggested death had been more surprising than painful. Anderson closed Lars's eyes. Anderson's own insides felt hollow. He was alone. He had lost Lars. He had lost Mina. He knuckled his eyelids.
Help!
Anderson went still, listening. The voice had been very small.
Help me!
He turned back toward the campfire where a heap of supplies and what must have been a tent or two lay smoking. The heap shook, and a bag of coffee slid to the ground. Anderson began tossing aside saddlebags. A bottle of whiskey smashed as he flung it aside. The kid Indian sat up. Blood ran down the side of his face. He clutched his head and hissed. "You okay?" The kid tried to nod, made a face. Up close, he wasn't quite as young as Anderson had first made him out to be, but he was maybe 18 at the oldest. The kid looked around the stinking, blasted camp.
"What happened?"
"I don't know."
"There was a light. The horses..."
The kid stopped. He looked sick.
"What the hell can do that kind of thing?"
"I don't know."
Anderson turned a bag of beans onto its side and plopped down on it. The rush of energy fear had given him had burned out, and now the long, tense day had caught up with him. It wouldn't be long until morning. He wanted nothing more than to close his eyes and sleep for a couple of hours, but he knew he couldn't. Mina was out there somewhere. He had to find her.
"You're the safecracker."
"Yeah."
The kid turned in a slow circle, studying the camp. He stooped beside the fire, studying something in the dirt. Whatever it was, he pocketed it.
"Where's your little girl?"
"Something got her. Her and McBurney. It took them across the creek."
Anderson thought about standing up, kept sitting.
"I've got to track them down."
"What do you know about tracking, City Slicker?"
McBurney must have told the gang about finding him on the streets of San Francisco and taking him in. He narrowed his eyes at the kid.
"I know enough."
The kid snorted. "I heard you crashing through the brush over there, trying to hide behind that cottonwood. If you knew anything about tracking, you would have managed a little better than that."
"So, you're a tracker."
The kid pulled a bag of tobacco out of his pocket.
"No shit."
"Why didn't you turn me in when you saw me?"
The kid shrugged. He bit off a twist of chaw and began turning it between his front teeth like a knot of spruce gum. Anderson studied him a moment or two. The kid was observant, that was for sure. Anderson had to admit to himself that without Lars's help he was going to have a hard time finding where that net had taken McBurney and Mina. He hadn't caught even a glimpse of the men behind the attack, hadn't heard any horses, hadn't seen anything. The only thing he could be sure of was the net. The net and some goddamn terrifying firepower.
"I want to hire you to help me track down my girl. Whatever your price is, I'll pay it."
The boy shot a string of spit into the campfire.
"Hell no. You see what those bastards did to this camp? You really want to have a run-in with men like that?"
"With a tracker like you, I won't have to have a run-in."
Anderson got off his sack of beans and stood in front of the kid.
"Those bastards have my little girl. I know you think that's wrong. Otherwise you would have turned me in the second you saw me behind that cottonwood."
"Shit."
The kid got to his feet.
"It won't be cheap."
"How much?"
$10.
"How much?"
$10.
It would mean digging up his cash beneath Bess's sycamore, but that didn't matter. He'd been saving that money for Mina. If something happened to her, that silver may as well rot.
"It's a deal."
Anderson put out his hand.
"What's your name, son?"
The kid shifted his plug of chaw into his cheek.
"Billy Novak, and I ain't your son, Sheriff. Let's keep this business only."
All right, Mr. Novak. Get your gear and we'll go back to my camp for horses.
Wait a second.
Novak held out his hand.
You should have this.
The corn dolly sat on his palm, ash-streaked and crumpled, but still whole. Anderson felt a surge of gratitude.
Thanks.
The kid grinned.
You're damn lucky to have me.
As the sun nosed up over the hills, Novak helped Anderson wrap Lars in the remnants of the gang's tents. There'd be time to bury him later, Anderson promised himself. He and the kid piled the gang's gear around the grisly bundle. He hoped it would be enough to keep the bodies safe from buzzards and vultures until he could take better care of it. After that business, it was a relief to walk away from the camp. In the dark, it had been bad. In the cold light of dawn, it was worse. Every bit of sand and stone had been pelted with blood and meaty bits. The stink was impossible. Anderson's stomach, luckily empty, turned around itself. He changed course, hurrying toward the place where he'd left his horse.
Wait,
Novak whispered, holding Anderson back. A body lay in the shallows. A big man, taller than Anderson and twice as wide. He clawed at the mud and then fell back, gasping. Novak's eyes narrowed.
Piss bucket.
His hand went to his cheek, where a second fresh bruise shone. Anderson waded to the big man's side and grabbed the back of his collar.
Morning, piss bucket.
He hauled him a foot higher up the beach. He'd never liked Piss Bucket Johnson, not even when they'd worked together. He hadn't recognized the fat man when he'd knocked Anderson into the creek last night, but he wasn't surprised he'd run away in the middle of a fight. He glanced at Novak. The kid folded his arms against his chest, his face dark. Anderson remembered his own time in the gang. Piss Bucket Johnson had his own way of making life hell for a teenaged boy. Piss Bucket groaned. Anderson worked his boot into the man's fleshy ribs and flipped him onto his back. The smell of burned meat overpowered Piss Bucket's eponymous aroma. The remnants of his coat and shirt hung in rags off his scorched chest.
What happened?
Piss Bucket's eyes shot open, his mouth opened and closed, fish-like, as he gasped in pain and fear. His burns were too severe for him to last much longer. Any other man, Anderson might have felt bad for.
A ghost, Piss Bucket gasped. A ghost!
What's he saying? Anderson slapped the fat man's face.
What did you see, Johnson?
A ghost!
Piss Bucket's eyes fluttered, then widened again.
I saw a ghost wading through the creek, an invisible ghost splashing around.
He twitched, jerked. I didn't see anything, Novak mused. Not a thing.
A ghost!
Piss Bucket went stiff, and then his head fell back.
Good riddance,
Anderson said. Novak drove his boot into the fat man's side.
Yeah.
They didn't say anything else until they were well away from the campsite and its horrors, the warm September sun drying the clothes they'd rinsed in the creek. Anderson kept slipping in and out of memory, the bad old days with the gang weaving into moments from Mina's childhood. He'd tried so hard to grow up and be a decent man for her, only to have his past come back and bite him in the ass.
I didn't see anything,
Novak said again. I thought it was just the darkness, the explosion, the noise. But now I wonder about it.
You're not saying Piss Bucket was right about you being attacked by a ghost.
Novak shook his head. No, of course not. If a spirit wanted revenge against McBurney, it wouldn't have carried him off in a net. Anderson couldn't argue with that logic. Plus, spirits don't leave footprints, and whoever's dragging that net definitely is.
What?
Novak pointed to the ground. I haven't even had to get off my horse. That net is leaving more traces than a mama grizzly on a rampage, but that there is definitely a footprint. Anderson pulled up his mirror and dismounted. Novak joined him on the ground.
You sure it's a footprint?
He'd never seen a print like this in his life. No man's foot had ever been this shape. The toe area was far too wide, and the whole thing was nearly twice as long as Anderson's. Maybe it's some new kind of caulk boot? Novak pointed out the strange indentations around the footprint, punctures in the earth like nothing so much as the imprint of four forward-pointing claws and one backward one. Anderson raised an eyebrow.
Hey, just trying to make sense of what I'm looking at.
Novak gave the print one last look and then got back in his saddle.
I think it's headed into the next canyon.
At least it's away from town and the mining camps, Anderson frowned. He knew that canyon all too well. He'd helped Lars move cattle through it every fall. And Ava was bringing the herd there today. The canyon followed the creek for 2 miles before it began to widen, the hills peeling back to let the sun play on the packed surface of the Nielsen's Road. Novak kept his eyes on the ground, following the scuff marks the invisible attackers had left. Anderson had chafed at waiting for sunrise, but he knew even a good tracker would have lost the trail in the dark. If the invisible men had left the creek and gone into the hills, they would have just vanished. Anderson opened the gate that marked the end of Lars and Ava's property. The big field stretched out ahead of them, the most open stretch of ground for miles. Here the net holding McBurney and Mina had cut a swath even Anderson could follow. A massive rumbling shook the ground, followed by a horrible clank and whine. Then the field went silent again.
What the hell was that?
Anderson slammed the gate behind him and climbed back on his horse.
Some kind of engine, maybe? It doesn't sound like it's working very well.
Novak patted his horse's neck. The mare was high-stepping, its nostrils flared. Anderson had never seen the creature look so nervous.
I don't like it. The trail goes over to that side of the field and then just stops.
A white horse caught Anderson's eye. Its rider was pushing it hard. He recognized the diminutive figure in the saddle from her slight build and the blue scarf tying her hat on tight.
John!
Ava called out, still a good ways away.
Where's Lars?
A quail shot up from the ground, startled by the horse, and she cut toward the edge of the field to avoid the beating wings. The flapping cut the air like gunfire, and just like that, she was gone. No horse, no rider, just grass and sky. The quail soared away, tiny as a sparrow.
Ava!
Anderson burst into a run. Had she fallen into a sinkhole? Had the ground simply swallowed her whole?
Ava!
With a resounding clang, the top of his head hit something hard, and he toppled backward into the grass. He lay still, his head spinning. His neck felt as if it had been stretched double.
John, are you all right?
The woman knelt beside him, her craggy face worried. She held up 3 fingers.
How many fingers?
4. No, damn it. He tried to sit up and let his head fall back again.
3. What are you doing out here?
Looking over the field before we move the herd. As if in response, somewhere farther up the canyon, a cow let out a bellow.
I've got Smokey and Jean rounding them up in the upper field.
Anderson winced. Here he was, laid out cold, and in a couple of hours this field would be filled with cattle. He and Novak didn't have much time to search out where they'd lost the net and its owner. The kid Indian's face filled his field of vision.
It's a ghost wagon. What the hell is this kid talking about?
You're the one who hit your head, but he's the one talking crazy,
Ava growled. Anderson forced himself upright. He rubbed the side of his aching neck.
What do you mean, Novak?
Pissbucket called it a ghost, the thing that attacked us last night, remember? And I didn't see anything, not a thing.
You two are looking for a ghost?
Ava looked from one to the other.
And where the hell is my husband?
Oh, Ava. Anderson reached for her wrinkled hand. He told her what happened during the night. His eyes filled up with salt. Lars was gone. His friend and deputy was really, really gone. She pulled her hand out of his grasp and covered her face. For a moment, she was motionless. Then she brushed her cheeks dry. She gave a fierce sniff.
I'm so sorry, Ava.
She shook her head.
There'll be time for that later. Your little girl is still out here somewhere. We've got to find her before something happens to her.
I think I know where she is, Novak said. Anderson had almost forgotten about him. He turned around to see the kid lying on his belly, his face close to the ground. The soil's dry enough, it doesn't take much of a print, and the ghost was walking careful here. It wasn't dragging the net at this point. He pointed at something Anderson couldn't make out. He stood here a moment waiting for something. The kid sprang to his feet.
I can picture it.
What? Ava snapped. I spent some time on the docks when we were in Frisco, Novak said. He jumped back a few feet, nodding. He pointed to a patch of broken grass, then a gopher hill. I'm sure you did too, Anderson, back when you were a kid. Anderson got to his feet.
Yeah. So, what's your point?
The ship's put out a gangway so they can load up their cargo, right? Like a big tongue coming out of the ship. Ava got up, running her hands along the air beside her, stroking something she could feel even if she couldn't see it.
A ghost gangway for a ghost wagon.
Right, Novak grinned at her. I was doing the same thing, Mrs.
You can call me Ava.
She rounded a corner, and the top half of her disappeared.
You can't see it, but you can feel it.
Anderson put out a tentative hand.
A ghost wagon.
He stroked the side of the thing. A slippery kind of warmth bit at his palm. He could feel his nerves crackling in his skin as if he touched a very tame form of lightning. You're saying Mina and McBurney got loaded up in this invisible ship like a load of beaver pelts?
Yeah. We've got to get in there.
The angry cow bellowed again. It sounded closer. Anderson smacked his hand against the invisible ship. They didn't have time for this shit. Ava reappeared.
How? There's not exactly a door to knock on.
Novak grinned.
I might have an idea.
The back end of Ava's herd looked more formidable than Anderson remembered. The times he'd ridden beside Lars urging his cows into the big field, the work had seemed boring, frustrating. The mass of cattle, a wall of balky, plodding flesh. Now Anderson saw them as Novak had described them. A wall, all right, but a wall that could pulp a man in its path. A wall that could break open anything, even a ghost wagon. Novak grew up listening to stories about walls of flesh like that. His Shasta grandmother had married a Sioux miner who'd come down out of the Dakotas looking for gold in the rush of 1849. The great herds of buffalo dotting the Dakota plains dwarfed Ava's herd by a thousandfold. His grandfather had been only a boy when he'd helped process the massive meat harvests, but he'd never forgotten it. And now Novak wanted to repeat history.
They call it a buffalo jump. They just stampede the buffalo right off a cliff, he explained, like a waterfall of animals. Ava had held up a hand.
Is this going to wipe out my herd? I'm counting on taking these to auction next week.
Novak shook his head. You felt what the ghost wagon is like. Top heavy. When the beeves hit it, they'll knock it over. At the speed they'll be running, it ought to smash right open.
What if it doesn't do anything?
Anderson asked.
Or what if Mina gets hurt?
You got a better idea? Novak shot. Anderson had to admit he didn't. Even right now, facing 300 head of cattle, he couldn't think of anything. He swiveled in his saddle. Novak stood beside a long, low heap of straw and wood that all but closed off this end of the field. He gave Anderson a nod and struck a match. Everything was ready. Anderson pulled out his revolver and shot three times into the air, startling the animals nearby. Novak dropped the match into the straw. The match hit the dry tinder and caught immediately. In less than a minute, flames began to run along the side of Novak's firewall. Anderson shot at the sky again, but it wasn't necessary. The cattle were already surging forward. Anderson urged his horse forward. The pounding hooves vibrated his very bones. Ava's hired hands whooped and waved torches, encouraging the cows into the side of the field where the ghost wagon sat. The terrible grinding and whining sound repeated itself, frightening the cows into a more desperate run. A blue crackling lit up the first wave of cattle. For a second, Anderson hardly understood what he was seeing. Something had appeared where the invisible wagon ought to be, a vehicle twice the size of a Conestoga wagon with a smooth, arched back. But what dazzled his brain was the gigantic man emerging from the trap door in its roof. His hair, was it hair, swirled around his strangely deformed face as he sighted down the ugliest rifle Anderson had ever seen. Bolts of white light shot out at the first wave of cattle. A cow's skull burst. The animals screamed and ran even faster. They hit the ghost wagon in a crash and shriek of metal and hooves. Anderson covered his ears, reeling at the sound. The giant man, no, by God, that face couldn't belong to a man, appeared in the middle of the herd, firing lightning bolts like a god with a vendetta. Anderson's revolver was suddenly in his hand. The tusked monster's head was a hell of a lot bigger than a can of tobacco. The revolver bucked in his grip, and the thing dropped. The cows trampled on, headed for the open grass.
Mina!
Anderson dug his heels into his horse's side. The river of cattle had flowed on by the ghost wagon, and he had to get inside. He didn't bother tying his horse, he just jumped off, running right into the dark mouth of the wagon's hatch. It was as if he'd entered the steaming mouth of hell. A low red light suffused the space, and a dense, acrid fog filled the air.
"What the hell is this?"
Novak whispered. Anderson hadn't heard the scout catch up with him.
"Mina!"
Anderson shouted. Novak shook his arm.
"Look."
The kid pointed to a clear box lying at their feet.
"That's a man's, ain't it?"
The raw, meaty thing in the box took a moment to resolve into a familiar shape. If Anderson hadn't helped Lars with the butchering, he might not have recognized the string of knobby bones running into the still bloody skull. How you got a man's spine out of his body without disconnecting it from his skull, Anderson didn't want to know.
"Anderson! That you? Help me!"
McBurney's voice came from the other side of the strange cargo hold. Novak kicked aside a pile of boxes full of more bloody trophies, revealing a black crate made of some slick material Anderson couldn't identify. A few narrow slits revealed McBurney huddled within. He pushed his fingers out through one of the gaps, desperate for human touch.
"Is Mina in there?"
"I don't know what that thing did with her.
Anderson dropped to his knees.
Oh, God, Mina!
Daddy! A tiny figure popped out from a dark spot in the wall, an open cabinet or a ventilation shaft, maybe. Daddy! Dirt coated every inch of his little girl, but when he swept her into his arms, she felt whole. She trembled and clung to him.
Mina!
The voice came from behind them. Anderson spun around. The figure silhouetted in the open hatch was far too large to be human. Novak reached for his rifle.
Mina,
the thing repeated, its voice a perfect mimic of Anderson's. It stepped inside but made no move toward them. It took another step sideways, moving into the darkness beyond the foggy cargo space.
Mina,
it said yet again.
Let's get the hell out of here,
Anderson said.
Wait! Don't leave me!
McBurney begged. His fingers closed on the fabric of Novak's jeans. Novak wrenched away.
I'm done with you, McBurney, you murdering, kidnapping bully.
Anderson grabbed Novak's arm.
Let's go.
The creature made some kind of sound as they passed it by, but they were moving too fast to understand if it was words or a threat or some bizarre alien call. They burst into the sunshine, gasping for air. The hatch closed behind them. There was another horrible, grinding, whining sound, and then a rushing whoosh. The ghost wagon vibrated and shook. Then it leaped into the air. It hovered for a moment, and then it streaked into the sky. A bird, a star. Gone. Ava walked toward them, her face streaked with smoke.
You all okay?
Anderson nodded, not sure of his voice, not sure of his eyes. What had he seen in there? What did that thing want with McBurney? Why hadn't it hurt Mina? The whole day and night had the weird unreality of a nightmare. Mina squeezed her arms tighter around his neck.
I knew you'd come for me, Daddy.
He tightened his grip on her. He'd changed his life to give her a better one. And his past had nearly gotten her killed. He wasn't sure if he deserved any of her faith, but at least he hadn't let her down.
I love you.
Novak looked from Ava to Anderson.
Either of you have any whiskey? Because I sure could use some.
Ava laughed and put her arm around the kid's shoulder.
You're all right, Novak.
Yeah, but now I don't have a job.
Anderson looked up from kissing Mina's head. Ava was giving him a hard look. He'd been just like Billy Novak once, a lost, scared kid looking for a better life. And Lars Nielsen had convinced the town of Coyote Creek to give him one.
I'm down a deputy, he said, and I could use someone who knows a thing or two about tracking.
Novak's mouth opened and closed. But no words came out. Anderson understood. It was a big jump from outlaw to law enforcement. While the boy flapped, Anderson settled Mina onto his horse.
I brought something of yours.
He pulled the corn dolly out of his pocket and watched her cover it with kisses. The smile on her face could have touched the heart of any kind of monster. He glanced at the sky.
Any kind of monster.
Drug War by Brian Thomas Schmidt and Holly Roberts. Chirping birds, insects, animals, and bustling traffic mixed with the lilting of people chattering in Portuguese all around him. The smell of mangoes, pineapple, exotic fragrances, piss, and petrol filled his nose. The marks of big city life. Retired LAPD Captain Mike Harrigan felt like he was in a different world until he stepped inside the modern convention center and heard a familiar voice.
Weapons of the future! The best technology! Load 'em up, blow 'em away!
It was a voice he hadn't heard in 25 years and never thought to hear again. Not since his time with the Los Angeles Police Department, a voice from a time of one of the biggest crises in his entire 40-year career. But here he was in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, of all places, and the former Fed, Garber, was standing right in front of him under a bright neon sign that read, Legends, Inc. Legendary Tech, Legendary Power. After what they'd both barely survived in Los Angeles, all they'd seen, Harrigan was a burned-out ex-cop who occasionally got invited to speak at urban police conferences like this one, and Garber had moved on to selling weapons and high-tech destruction. Harrigan wondered which of them had learned the most from their experience with the alien bounty hunter. Vendor booths lined both sides of the long entryway leading to exhibit halls, theaters, meeting rooms, and more of the Rio de Janeiro Convention Center. Crowds of cops, military types, private security, mercenaries, and more examined the wares. As Garber hefted a long, sleek, heavy-looking weapon, a rifle of some sort with laser scope, attached grenade launcher, and two cartridge bays, a chubby, sunburned, flowery-shirted American tourist poster child and his shorter, round wife stopped and smiled.
"Awesome," the man said. "Me and my pebbles need something just like that there back in Texas."
Garber smiled his best salesman smile.
"Totally legal, folks. I can set you up today."
From behind the Americans, a tall woman with long black hair and seductively tanned skin approached with her companion, a shorter, bulkier, older man with a well-developed paunch like Harrigan's. Both wore sidearms holstered at their belts, despite their three-piece brown suits, and as they turned, Harrigan spotted badges hanging from their belts. Detectives.
"Amigo, what is that thing?"
the woman asked in the lilting Brazilian accent that had grown so familiar.
"Ah, policia," Garber said, smiling broadly as he met her eyes. "This is the answer to all your problems, officers. The LI-547B1, the only assault rifle you'll ever need once you own it." "It looks heavy, like a monstrosity," her partner said, shaking his head. "You expect us to run with that?"
Garber grunted.
"Why run when everyone else will? Once you whip out this baby, it's over. You can stop them from 60 yards away. Pow!"
He chuckled.
"Problem entering a building? One blast from the grenade, and you can blow your own entryway right through a wall. Blam!"
As he described it, Garber demonstrated each move by aiming the weapon and pretending to shoot, shaking it for emphasis at each explosion. Harrigan rolled his eyes, and the two detectives exchanged a look.
"If it's even legal," the female said.
"Oh, trust me, down here it's totally legal, or else I wouldn't be here," Garber said.
Her companion shook his head again.
"It's insane, amigo. The department would never approve that." "What if I told you they had?" Garber argued.
Just then the floor vibrated, and Harrigan heard the distant thrum of a big explosion outside. As people around them muttered and exchanged looks, Harrigan and the two cops raced for the door simultaneously, the automatic glass doors opening wide in their path to emit distant screams and further explosions. They stepped out onto the sidewalk and scanned the area surrounding the convention center, their eyes finding a nearby hillside slum where smoke drifted into the deep blue sky, a few buildings in flames as people yelled and scattered down the perilously narrow, steep sidewalks and passages between shacks, trying to get away. Garber ran up to join them then.
"What the hell was that?" "It's Cortado Centro," the male detective said as he squinted toward the hillside. "Favela, slum."
Another explosion rocked the hillside, debris, flames, and smoke flying outward to form a funnel.
"Merda! What is going on?"
the female detective inquired.
"Holy shit!"
Garber exclaimed, spotting something through his weapon scope.
"What?"
Harrigan asked. Garber looked at him, recognition dawning in his eyes.
"Harrigan? LAPD?"
"Retired 2 years now,"
Harrigan replied with a nod.
"Garber?"
Garber grunted and handed him the weapon, pointing high on the hillside where a building burned. Through the scope, Harrigan soon saw it too, a body hanging from a tree, human and bloody. It had been skinned head to toe. The sight was one that had haunted Harrigan's nightmares for 25 years, ever since the Predator. He couldn't believe he was seeing it.
"It can't be." "You know it is," Garber replied.
"What?" The female detective asked anxiously.
They're under attack, Garber said, taking his gun back. Time to arm up!
Garber turned back for the convention center.
Hang on, let me get my stuff.
He ran back inside.
Attack? By what? This kind of thing happens with drug dealers a lot,
the male detective said.
Harrigan shook his head. Trust me, we've seen this before. We gotta clear the area, lock it down.
Without further word, Harrigan was running off toward the burning slum, and the two detectives followed.
Lock it down from what?
The female detective called after him. The three detectives stopped at a busy intersection, racing across as soon as there was an opening, the vehicles whizzing by with narrow misses just as they reached the other side. No one even seemed to have slowed at all.
Jesus!
Harrigan muttered as he felt the vibration of a speeding box truck racing by, the smell of petrol and sweat mixing with chemicals, piss, and other unpleasantries common to Rio's streets, as he'd discovered.
Who are you?
The female detective asked, looking at him as they ran.
Mike Harrigan, former LAPD,
Harrigan replied.
Ana Rios and Rodrigo Vilasa,
the female said, motioning to her partner.
Metro Police, homicide.
Harrigan nodded a greeting as they continued running.
Nice to meet you. You wanna tell us what's going on?
Vilasa asked. They rushed onward, reaching the base of the hill, where screaming men, women, and children were rushing out of the makeshift buildings and walkways.
A hunter hunting humans, Harrigan said.
What?
Rios replied.
A serial killer?
Yeah, kinda like that, Harrigan said. And we'd better hope to God there's only one.
Rapido! Rapido!
Fernando cried to his neighbor's passel of kids, swatting their little behinds as they bolted away. One of them breathlessly paused to glance up at Fernando, tears welling in his little 7-year-old eyes.
Obrigado, Fernando.
Their mother, Solange, was away when an explosion rocked the favela, upturning the table where Fernando and his grandmother were having lunch and their usual argument about how he was wasting his life. It started, of course, with the flamboyant blouse. His grandmother chastised him in Portuguese while pulling Peo de Queijo out of the pathetic makeshift wood-burning oven.
You think you are special, Fernando?
She gestured to the blouse, adorned in colorful palm fronds, tropical plants, with a giant tiger's face smack dab at the center.
I like it. It makes me feel fierce.
Then when her back was turned, Fernando gave an obstinate shimmy in her direction. Her head swiveled around to give him the stink eye. Granny saw everything.
You'll see, Avo,
Fernando said confidently.
I'm not destined for life in the favela. I am going to be a star.
Licking the cherry gloss on his lips, he smiled.
I'll soon be acting alongside Brad Pitt and Ryan Gosling in major motion pictures.
She snorted derisively and settled her creaky bones into a rickety chair, only to be catapulted out when the explosion hit. Fernando blinked hard, finding himself splayed on the ground next to his grandmother, balls of Peo de Queijo bouncing and rolling around their heads. Jumping to his feet, Fernando hauled his granny up and out of the shack. The streets were swarming with cariocas fleeing the favela. Smoke visibly rolled through the air. It was too close. Solange's kids called out from next door. They were trapped inside. Grabbing a fleeing man, Fernando firmly transferred his granny's hand onto the man's arm, instructing him to get her out safely. With a grave nod, the man took off, dragging protesting grandma behind him, while Fernando hastened to help the neighbor's kids. Now that they were out, Fernando knew he needed to get his own fabulous, unsinged butt out of there, too. That's when he saw the trio fighting against the flow of cariocas. They stuck out like a bad perm in a sea of salon-styled hair. Policia. Two of them, along with an older black man, his face an arrangement of ferocious intensity. They were all armed and stalking further into the favela. The woman, Policia, shouted over the crowd to the black man.
If you are retired, what are you doing here at an arms conference, Harrigan?
Harrigan shot her a glance.
If Los Angeles has taught me anything, Rios, it's that war can break out at any time, anywhere, by anything. I'm all about being prepared.
Los Angeles. Fernando's heart thudded in a different fervor of excitement now. If he could just get to the City of Angels, he could be a star. Everyone who moved to Hollywood was instantly given opportunities and made into movie stars. Fernando looked closer, but didn't recognize this Harrigan person, but maybe Fernando just hadn't seen his movies yet. Harrigan stopped to squint up at the smoke plumes.
Are you sure we're going in the right direction? I feel like we are running in circles.
Fernando stepped directly in front of Harrigan, forcing him to stop, and grinned.
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker!
He deepened his voice, despite his heavy accent.
He's the disease, and we're the cure.
He still had some work to do on his Stallone impression.
Get out of my way,
the cop growled. Pointing up at the smoke plumes, Fernando tried a new tactic.
You want to be there? You need my help. It's a honey brush in here.
The man called Harrigan gave Fernando a strange, uncomprehending look. The other two policia slowed to a stop.
Honeycomb,
the other policia man corrected him.
Come on, Vilasa,
the woman called Rios said to her partner.
We don't have time for this.
They hurried past Fernando, but he refused to get out of Harrigan's way. Seeing as Harrigan was about to slam him to the side if need be, Fernando spoke quickly.
They won't find it either. This place is a honeycomb.
He used the correct phrase this time.
I help you get there fast. You help me get to the City of Angels.
Harrigan shook his head like he didn't have time for this, until he saw his two policia friends double back, having taken the wrong way the first time.
Take me there,
Harrigan said through tightened teeth. Hope blossomed in Fernando's chest, and he couldn't help the smile spreading across his face.
And you'll get me to City of Angels?
Can we discuss this later?
Harrigan said, as an explosion rocked a nearby shack and sent debris raining down on them. Fernando whirled around and led him to where the smoke billowed up, darkening the sky. Hurrying up and down the winding paths of the favela, past rusting housing units, Fernando was about to tell him they were close when another explosion hurled them to the ground. Sputtering out puffs of sandy dirt, Fernando lifted his head and turned to see if his new buddy was okay. White sand was caked to the side of Harrigan's unhappy, dark face. Extending an arm, Fernando pointed just around the corner of the next building.
There!
Harrigan tried to jump to his feet quickly, but the way he moved and the wince on his face told Fernando he had creaky bones like grandmother. Getting up with more ease to follow, Fernando smacked into Harrigan when he abruptly stopped. Peeking around him, Fernando saw what made him stop. All hell had broken loose. The slanted wood and clay roof next to him exploded as Harrigan followed the Brazilian up the winding narrow walkways through the favela. Pieces of clay, wood, dried palm leaves, and dirt rained down on their heads as they both ducked instinctually, even while they kept running.
Merda,
the Brazilian man muttered. Then they rounded a corner and entered a small square, and the man stopped cold, staring, his jaw dropped open.
Mea de Dios,
he whispered. Harrigan saw it too, a decapitated corpse lying in a heap, the head beside it on the cement covering the square, just a few feet from where they'd left the walkway. Blood was still pouring from the body and head, forming crimson pools. To the left, another body lay, stabbed through the chest with a gaping wound, a kind Harrigan had seen before, the predator's spear. The decapitation had clearly happened from one of those computerized frisbee-like discs they carried. Scorched marks smoked on the sides of buildings and a patch of cement between the two bodies. Body laser. The stench of burnt concrete and blood, now mixed with that of the urine, mud, sweat, and general uncleanliness of the favela. A familiar clicking sound echoed from the distance. The creature. This shit was not happening again. Not while Harrigan could stop it. His memories of the last time had not faded one iota over the 2 decades since. If anything, they'd become more vivid. It was a situation he'd never thought he'd face again, and yet somehow he'd always known, always feared the aliens would be back. But this time he had an advantage. This time he knew what to do, and whatever it took, he'd do it. Automatic weapons fire exploded above them, further up in the favela, tearing apart more roofs, trees, and more, followed by screams and yelling. These people are poor? Drug lords? He put a gentle hand on the Brazilian's shoulder as the man stood frozen, staring at the bodies.
Hey, buddy, what's your name?
No response. Harrigan squeezed his shoulder.
Buddy!
The Brazilian mumbled.
Fernando.
Okay, Fernando. Who's doing the shooting out there?